Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Two Wellington homes have been completely destroyed in a house fire overnight. The fire was in Hanson Street in the suburb of Newtown. It spread from one house to its neighbours, and at its peak, more than 20 fire engines were fighting it. Our reporter John Gerritsen lives nearby and is outside the burnt down houses. John, what can you see this morning?
Well, it's a bit of a shock, quite frankly, Philippa. I walk past these houses every day on my way to work, and basically one of them is barely there at all. All you can see is some sort of blackened framing. There's no roofing at all. And the one next to it is just completely gutted. Its roof is gone, but the front of the house is still there. But you can see inside, and you can tell it's been completely burnt out. And I know one of these houses, well, at least, was pretty derelict. To be honest, it looked abandoned, and it has done for all the years that I've been here. And I overheard the fire officers speaking about this. Quite a few of the houses around were also affected, and something like 40 people had to be evacuated out of their homes while they fought the blaze.
Can you see any damage to the houses that are alongside them?
I can't, unfortunately. There's quite a few trees. These two houses that we can see, they're sort of set back from the road and about 20 feet up some steps. So they're very visible. There's other houses behind them and either side, and the fire service were saying that basically on three sides, all the houses on all around, but were in some way affected by this fire.
Because in this street, the houses are quite close together, aren't they? If you could, you know, it's early Wellington houses. How would you describe the street?
Yeah, absolutely. These are all, you know, maybe 100-year-old houses. As I say, these ones in particular were really derelict. But it's your classic sort of Newtown houses. There's very little space between each house. These two houses that are burnt, there's probably only, 10 feet between them, maybe. And, you know, Newtown's one of those areas where, you know, if there's an earthquake, it's regarded as a big fire hazard because these wooden houses are so close together.
Is the street blocked off? Or what are the emergency services doing this morning?
There is one truck here with hoses, and they've got metal bridges for driving over the hoses, and you can sometimes hear cars going past. So they're letting cars through, but it's down to one lane.
Thank you very much for that. That's our reporter, John Gerritsen, who lives near where two Wellington homes were completely destroyed overnight. And we'll be keeping up with this story later in the program.
The government is offering people thousands of dollars cash back if they buy an electric vehicle in a rebate scheme that was announced yesterday. The scheme will be funded through levies on high-emission vehicles from the 1st of January 2022. Transport Minister Michael Wood says the clean car discount will prevent up to 9 million tonnes of carbon dioxide emissions and will help with the upfront cost of switching from petrol-run vehicles. But it's being met with vigorous opposition from National and ACT, who say it's a tax by stealth that will hit working people. Joining me now is the National Party's transport spokesperson, Michael Woodhouse. Morning, Mr. Woodhouse.
Kia ora, Nathan.
Hey, do you accept that New Zealand's vehicle fleet needs to go electric?
Absolutely, and for incentivising that transition, I think there's merit in the subsidies. But we don't support the taxing of tradies, farmers and large families in order to be able to pay for the subsidy. We think that's quite wrong.
So how does it feel like a tax on these people then?
Well, their car prices are going to go up. We currently have probably record numbers of light commercial vehicles coming into the fleet for people like farmers and tradies. Those prices are going to go up by over $3,000. Now, for low-income New Zealanders and large families, that's also going to be in effect because there are no EVs and hybrids that would suit their needs or that they can afford. But the prices of those vehicles are also going to go up, and we think it's a bad policy. It's a tax.
So it's going to be very hard to get someone selling a car to just instantly drop the price. So would you be in favour of more of a subsidy?
Well, on EVs, you mean?
Yes.
Look, I'm not sure that the incentive is actually going to change the mind of somebody who was looking for a new vehicle. But remember, you're talking about $70,000. And I don't know about you, but I don't know that there's too many people who are able to go out and purchase a $70,000 car, even if there is an $8,000 subsidy on it. In the meantime, we're going to have a large number of New Zealanders that need to purchase vehicles that will still be petrol for the foreseeable future because of their geography, where they live, what work they do, and how big their families are, and they're going to have to pay more.
Do you think, though, that that price might come down as we go further in the future? And, you know, this is, I'm just thinking, I only know fourth form economics, supply and demand. As there's more supply, won't the price drop on those?
Well, let's start with supply, because there's no doubt that as the stock of EVs goes up, the price point will come down. The minister actually said that yesterday. And in terms of whole of life costs, it's going to approach parity in the not too distant future. So the market will respond to that. The large vehicle manufacturers have said that they're going to be transitioning to EVs as quickly as they possibly can. But punishing people along the way who aren't able to afford or don't have a model that they can buy is not good policy. It's a tax.
So what's your solution for those people then right now?
For those that want to buy EVs, I think the incentive is fine. There could have been other things they could have done in respect of fringe benefit tax, for example. But don't punish people along the way would be my advice. It's also important to keep in mind that the likelihood is that the second-hand petrol car market will also respond to that price point. And so even if you're not buying an imported vehicle, it may be that the price of those cars goes up. We say don't do that. Incentivise EVs, absolutely. But don't punish people who can't pay.
Mm. So would a national government, would it scrap the clean car discount package then?
Not necessarily the clean car discount package, but we would certainly not be imposing a tax on those people who can't afford or can't use those vehicles.
Excellent. Michael Woodhouse, thank you very much for your time this morning. There is the National Party's transport spokesperson, Mr. Michael Woodhouse.
The government's being accused by National of acting like a reverse Robin Hood. From July this year, people buying new electric vehicles could get as much as $8,625 back from the government. The clean car discount scheme will be funded through levies on high emission vehicles from next year. Both National and ACT say it's a tax by stealth that will hit working people. Here's RNZ political reporter Charlie Drever.
The Transport Minister, Michael Wood, is hoping to put the handbrake on gas-guzzling vehicles making their way into the country.
If we don't move forward with policies like the Clean Car Standard and the Clean Car Discount, New Zealand will become a dumping ground for the world's dirtiest vehicles. At the moment, we have one of the dirtiest fleets coming into our country because of the lack of a standard to date. We're resolving that.
Under the clean car discount, imported electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles, both new and used, will be eligible for a rebate. To pay for this, cars imported with high emissions will cost extra from next year. For example, a Toyota Hilux brought into the country could incur a fee of $2,900. The announcement comes hot on the heels of the Climate Change Commission's report on how the country should move towards net zero emissions by 2050. Climate Change Minister James Shaw says transport has the fastest growing emissions profile in New Zealand.
Dealing with the energy that we use to get around within our cities and between our cities is one of, if not the most urgent of all of our climate change challenges.
The scheme is predicted to bring an additional 19,000 clean vehicles into the country's vehicle fleet in the first year of operation. Drive Electric Chair Mark Gilbert says hundreds of thousands of EVs are needed to meet the government's climate targets, and the announcement is a step change.
Most importantly, this announcement says to global car manufacturers, New Zealand is serious about EVs. We're really looking forward to seeing their response in the form of new ranges and new models, perhaps including utes eventually.
The Greens' Julianne Jenta failed to get a similar scheme over the line last term, thanks to New Zealand First throwing a spanner in the works. But now, with just Labour at the wheel, the scheme has been able to forge ahead, albeit with changes such as a vehicle price cap of $80,000. RNZ understands that part of the reason the scheme wasn't announced sooner was because Labour and the Greens were fighting over details of the scheme. However, both ministers were reluctant to say any concessions had been made.
My sense is that broadly we're all feeling very comfortable,
yeah.
But James, I'll let you speak to that.
We're delighted with it, yeah.
Great answer.
Someone who is not delighted is National's transport spokesperson, Michael Woodhouse.
We welcome incentives, but my concern is that so many New Zealanders, tradies, large families, people in rural and remote areas, are going to be asked to pay
for this, but not actually have the choice to benefit from it. In essence, it's a reverse Robin Hood system. They're taking from the poor to give to the rich, and that's just not right.
He says National supports more positive moves, such as exempting EVs from fringe benefit tax, extending road user charge exemptions, and allowing EV users access to bus lanes and free parking. The Motor Industry Association CEO David Crawford is happy with the announcement, especially the level of rebate on offer. But he did think the government could go even further.
The 80,000K cut-off is about $20,000 too low. And with four commercial sectors like businesses, the discount being taken off before FBT is a step in the right direction. But we would have still preferred to have seen an FBT discount by 50% to help offset their higher cost.
He says countries with high EV uptake have changed their tax system a lot more, which is why a fringe benefit discount would be beneficial.
The motor industry says the government's new fee-bate scheme for electric vehicles will not tempt most New Zealand car buyers. From next month, people buying new imported EVs could get more than $8,000 back, funded from a levy on people who buy high-emitting, gas-guzzling vehicles. But a retailer warns it will just be a sugar rush that wears off quickly. National's transport spokesperson Michael Woodhouse is less than impressed.
We welcome incentives, but my concern is that so many New Zealanders, tradies, large families, people in rural and remote areas are going to be asked to pay for this, but not actually have the choice to benefit from it. In essence, it's a reverse Robin Hood system. They're taking from the poor to give to the rich, and that's just not right.
Shortly we'll hear from the Transport Minister, Michael Wood, but first, this from Hamish Cardwell.
David Boot owns and runs electric vehicle retailer EV City in Christchurch. He opened the shop at midday and says the announcement of government rebates for imported new and used EVs had an immediate effect.
By about 12:30, we'd sold our first vehicle due to the release of the information. Finished the day on 7 sales, which is probably 4 more than we would normally do on a Sunday.
From July the 1st, people buying imported new EVs can get a rebate of more than $8,500. For used ones, it is just about $3,500. New plug-in hybrids attract about a $5,700 rebate, while for used, it's $2,300. John, who owns a hybrid and was window shopping at a Wellington car dealership when I caught up with him, doesn't like the idea.
No, I think that's a bit silly. I think people should pay for what they buy. Don't think government's not part of it.
But most others think it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's just a matter of time, really, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? It's the way the world's going at the minute. Everything's going electric, so, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, they've got to encourage it. They really have to, you know, some incentives.
Wellingtonian Yannick Grundy says it could put an EV within his reach.
I made a commitment to myself a few years ago that my first car would be an electric car, and I think this makes it a lot more possible for people like myself to make that a reality.
Abby Askey says the rebate on second-hand imported EVs is the game-changer.
I think we've looked up, like, what's the one that you're obsessed with?
Nissan Leaf.
The Nissan Leaf.
Yeah.
You can get for, I think, 16,000 used. Like, that's a huge amount, especially when the running costs are then so low.
But EV City owner David Boot says while the announcement gives the industry a real shot in the arm, it may not last long. He says retailers rushing into the EV market will push up demand and therefore prices. The Motor Trade Association represents the auto industry, and its chief executive, Craig Pormore, says the rebate will not be enough for many consumers to make the switch to electric. He says you can get a really good new petrol car for about $30,000 compared to new EVs at around $68,000.
Even if I take the 8K subsidy off that, that's still a 20K difference on a new EV in some instances. So whilst it's a great leap forward, there's still a big gap between the price of that new EV and a very, very good model, petrol or diesel.
Craig Pormare says most New Zealanders just do not buy new cars. And he says New Zealand is near the bottom of the queue for EVs, which are in huge international demand.
Our members who sell cars would love to get their hands on as many EVs as they can. The big manufacturers overseas are saying this side of 2030, it's highly unlikely that we'll be able to produce enough, certainly along the lines that the government is looking for.
He is disappointed the standard hybrids that you see a lot in New Zealand, like the ones used by taxi and Uber drivers, are not covered by the rebate. The government will finance the rebates by slapping a fee on larger gas-guzzling vehicles beginning next year. Federated Farmers President Andrew Hoggard says there are no EV alternatives available for the heavier types of vehicles farmers and tradespeople use, and there is unlikely to be any for at least 4 years.
Basically, it's just going to be an additional cost, and I guess what I'd like to see is, you know, some sort of waiver until there are those alternatives on the market.
Andrew Hoggard says it is unfair to ping people needing vehicles for work.
But everyone else that wants to buy a double cab Ranger just to drive it into, you know, the middle of Wellington and park it up so they look cool, you're going to get slapped with it.
But Andrew from Wellington says the move is good for the environment and farmers and tradespeople just have to suck it up.
Life's not fair, eh? Do you know what I mean? So, like, it is what it is. You just got to take it on the chin, like.
The scheme is predicted to bring an additional 19,000 clean vehicles into the country's vehicle fleet in the first year of operation. To qualify, cars must cost less than $80,000 and have at least a 3-star safety rating. The rebates will also expand from January the 1st to include low-emissions vehicles, not just electric and plug-in hybrids.
In INA, an increasing number of New Zealand businesses are paying ransoms to cyber criminals, with some paying hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's according to a cybersecurity expert who says some clients are so paralysed by the attacks, they've no choice but to pay. Anusha Bradley reports.
At the end of May last year, just as the country was emerging from the national lockdown, Fisher & Paykel Appliances was hit by a ransomware attack. Rudy Khoury, Fisher & Paykel's head of marketing and digital transformation, was one of the first people to realise what was happening. It's the first time the company's speaking publicly about it.
We noticed through our detection that something was happening, and we were able to stop it from moving through our networks and through our systems. Once you're in that situation, you trust nothing in your systems anymore, so you assume that everything is compromised.
Some of the company's files were encrypted and stolen by the cyber criminal group Nephilim. The attack stopped manufacturing for a couple of days, but it took several weeks before business was back to normal. Mr. Khoury says the hackers sent an email to some Fisher & Paykel executives threatening to leak the stolen files to the dark web if they didn't pay a hefty ransom.
We had no intention of paying, and our decision was absolutely not to pay.
Government figures show malware attacks, which include ransomware, increased 2008% last year. Campbell McKenzie, the founder of computer forensic and security company Incident Response Solutions, is seeing this firsthand.
So I first worked on a ransomware case around about 6 or so years ago. I have seen year on year ransomware attacks on New Zealand organisations roughly double. And over the last year, I've seen where ransomware attacks occur and there's been a theft of data at the same time, that has roughly quadrupled over the last year.
He says an increasing number of businesses, including some of his clients, feel they have no choice but to pay up.
You have those that would just never in a million years pay a ransom because you're paying money to a criminal group. And then you have those that are essentially facing an existential threat because they've lost all of their data and they can't do business. And they're essentially forced into having to pay. I've seen very small organisations pay around $5,000 to get their data back, but I've seen threats on very large organisations for significantly more than that, into the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Mr. McKenzie says while it's strongly discouraged, any ransom that is paid from New Zealand must comply with anti-money laundering laws to prevent the funding of terrorism. The American company Coveware helps businesses, including some in this country, pay ransoms to cyber criminals. But it says the average amount being demanded has fallen by about $100,000 US in the last 3 months to around $130,000, as more companies are refusing to pay. Australia is considering forcing those who do pay to report it so the government knows how often it happens and that payments comply with the law. The Digital Economy and Communications Minister David Clark says that's not being discussed as an option in this country.
There's always a risk where there's mandatory reporting of those kinds of things that people then shy away from engaging with official agencies.
While there are no official figures on how often ransoms are paid in New Zealand, Mr. Clark says the government has a very clear stance that it shouldn't be done because it only emboldens the criminals.
It's 29 past seven. New Zealand needed only an hour on day four to complete victory in the second test in Birmingham late last night, handing them a first series win in England in 22 years. The victory also lifts the Black Caps back to number one in the World Test rankings. Stand-in captain Tom Latham said the win is an ideal boost ahead of facing India in next week's World Championship final.
From our point of view, it was about coming here and focusing on these first two test matches against England and trying to continue doing what we've been doing over a couple of years now. And I thought we did that really well over the two test matches. And now that we've ticked that one off, it's important that our focus shifts to India in a couple of days.
Well, watching at Edgbaston was BBC cricket journalist Henry Moran. Henry, kia ora, good morning. Thank you for talking to us today. Emphatic there for New Zealand with the win. How embarrassing was it, though, to be an England fan?
Oh, good morning to you, Susie. It wasn't great. There was a lot of talk early on in the day and last night about how long England's final wicket might last. Could they possibly scramble 30 runs that would give them maybe just a 1% chance? We were all there, we were all ready, and then it was one ball before the innings was over. It didn't take long, and at that point, the game was done. I think the real frustration for England cricket supporters is this was the first match where they'd been able to attend in almost full numbers since the start of the pandemic. So 18,000 people have been able to attend these games, and you've had, I think, about 10,000 tickets were sold for this afternoon and through today. And so there was a real disappointment for those supporters that weren't able to see a full day's play. And that's before you get started on the England performance in this game. It was pretty abject, I've got to say. England, they're not, let's not make any bones about it, they're not as good a side as New Zealand and India by virtue of looking at the rankings. We know that, but England would expect in their home condition at Edgbaston, a ground that they are traditionally very successful at, to do an awful lot better than a heavy defeat like the one we've seen.
So what does that say about the New Zealand team and how impressive they are?
And there's a number of elements to why this is such an impressive performance. First of all, you look at the squad that played in this second test match compared to the first. Six changes to the starting 11. No Kane Williamson in that side as well. The leader, the icon, the player that has led them to this wonderful run of form in test cricket and form across all formats. He was missing. Tom Latham comes in. And this team just doesn't seem to stop with that momentum, that form, that consistency. It is such an impressive unit. And it was really interesting at the end of the game when the presentations were taking place. Kane Williamson, who was captain for the first game of this series, made sure that it was Tom Latham that was pushed to the front that got to lift the trophy. It is clear how strong a unit this New Zealand team is and how even if you change six changes, over half the team changed, that they are still a hugely effective unit and that they're able to beat what should be one of the world's best teams in their own backyard.
I was going to ask you about that next week's the World Championship final. How likely are New Zealand to be extremely confident going into that, I suppose, with this win, but how likely can they challenge India, even with them being back to number one in the World Test rankings?
I think there's a few elements at play here. First of all, New Zealand's build-up to this Test Championship final has been as good as you could wish it to be. Two competitive Test matches against a good Test side in the conditions that you'll be playing the final in. India haven't had that. They've been in the UK for a couple of weeks. They played inter-squad games, but they've not played the cut and thrust of international Test match cricket. That's a huge benefit to the New Zealand side. Also, the ball that's going to be used. It's a Duke's cricket ball. They traditionally swing more than perhaps you would see in other parts of the world. That should suit the New Zealand bowlers who far outperformed England, I should say, in the last couple of weeks. So the likes of Trent Bolt, Tim Southey, as he plays, and Matt Henry, who was superb in this game, just gone. They should be able to really make the most of these conditions and the ball that's being used. And as well as that, you've got a New Zealand side that are just so full of confidence. India, they'll be finding their feet in the conditions. New Zealand, they've just won a series for the first time against England in England in over 20 years. They will be going to Southampton thinking, this is a huge opportunity for us to take home an ICC trophy. 2 years ago, it didn't quite happen. There's no reason for them to think on this occasion that they can get the job done.
Thank you very much for talking to us this morning. That's Henry Moran. BBC cricket journalist who was watching that match at Edgbaston. Back here, the police are using or trialling several tools to search social media networks during investigations, but they won't say what ones. They say the tools are used to scan publicly accessible, so-called open source internet pages. Some tools are controversial overseas, for instance, being used to track Black Lives Matter protesters. RNZ's Phil Pennington looking into this one. Phil, kia ora, good morning. Thanks for being with us. No names for what tools they're using here.
No names here, Susie. In the OAA, what we have is them saying that they have used three social media search tools since 2018, including on cybercrime and the mosque terror attacks investigation. They used these, they say, to search accessible and open source internet pages, including social media. It includes one that the National Intelligence Centre only brought in November 2019 for police's first ever dedicated internet search team, well after the March 15 attacks. We know they want to trial another social search tool too, but they won't name them. They say providing any such information to criminals would only harm the community and the public interest, and that the business cases for these tools identify capability gaps that could be exploited. Digital rights groups, of course, they worry that online surveillance is only proliferating, and with it, the ethical hazards around this, Susie.
Isn't it smart, though, not to show their hand to criminals?
Well, maybe. I mean, we know electronic chatter has been proved to give leads on crime and security threats, and, of course, the whole covert high-tech approach got a real boost last week from local involvement in that worldwide gang bust that depended on a Trojan horse FBI app. On the other hand, police have been trying for the last year to build up public confidence and get social license for deploying more high-tech crime-fighting tools, including by being more transparent. And they did name 20 other tech systems that they already use or eyeing up.
Now, what about the Stocktake? This was in the Stocktake late last year.
Yeah, they named those systems in the Stocktake, the first one. They called that at the time a baseline, but they now say to me that this was a quick snapshot without the details and that it was not presented as being comprehensive or reaching into every corner of the organisation. The word social media occurred just once in that Stocktake and not in relation to a search tool. That is surprising. That does appear to be a gap, given how intricately people's lives are tied up with social media and the fact that most police forces surveyed worldwide are analysing social media at scale.
If we knew what the tools were, Phil, how would that help?
Well, I think it would help. We would be able to more widely check what these tools are, how they're used overseas, misused overseas, so we would know what to watch out for. We could OIA for any privacy impact assessments done on them. The sorts of systems I was asking police about include Dataminer, that's used by police in the US to monitor Black Lives Matters protesters, something called Social Sentinel, which has been credited with deterring school shootings, but also has been accused of spying on teachers, and Babel Street. This can even track emojis and has been used in the dark web. Police told me that they will be proactively releasing further information in the near future on this. I'm not sure what that means.
What about privacy assessments? Have these been done?
Not on these tools, it seems not. Police say that they've told the Privacy Commissioner, they are looking at developing these assessments on these social tools. But the Commissioner himself, John Edwards, says he has consulted with them about the searching of open source internet pages generally, but not about any specific proposal other than a social media brand building software called Zavy. We know that in the past the police have been patchy on doing privacy impact assessments on tech. Now, if we knew the names of what these social search tools were, that would help us to check on that.
Now, does the new OIA name any social media search tools?
Yes, and it gets interesting here because they say that they have previously disclosed that they use something called Maltego, and they use this to query open source data and visualise it in graphic form. Well, Maltego also has other software on offer, for instance, Social Links, and this is used can be used to scan for data on 50 social networks, including Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, you know, the usual suspects, and the dark web. The new external panel of experts that the police have set up on this part of their transparency push, they say they have not reviewed anything off the list of a dozen, well actually two dozen social and facial recognition tools that we put to police. That panel of experts has not reviewed any of those. They are looking at the proposal to trial a new tool, and they have reviewed a new report into the ethical use of algorithms, and we expect that to be released soon, Susie.
Thank you very much. Phil Pennington, our reporter there.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.